what LHC has to do with string theory or things, but let's try. So on Monday, well, the organizers wanted to set up something to have fun with and to pursue the idea of beginning to learn how to connect the theory and the physics better. So on Monday, I presented a set of information which would be kind of like what the experimenters would present when the time came, when there was data. Based on the, well, first, there's a lot of people who are here now who weren't here Monday, and so it makes sense to do some of that again. So partly what I'll do now is repeat that, but I also added some information, I added a couple clues, and also I got a lot of questions over the last couple days, so I want to repeat some stuff and explain some stuff. So I'll talk for a while about this particular thing, and then as I understand it, we should just have a kind of general discussion or maybe questions and some answers, but I'm not the only one who can answer questions. There are others here who are experts in various pieces of this, and you heard Paul talk earlier as well, and that should be included. And a lot of this is stuff that Brent Nelson has had a lot to do with, and he certainly is expert on a large number of these issues. So let me start talking about some of these things and go through this, and don't hesitate to stop me and discuss it. I've repeated a little bit of some parts of the talk from Monday in terms of some of these issues. So why is string theory connected at all with these things, or how do you go from a 10-dimensional theory? Well, you all know that when you get to four dimensions by one or another root and break supersymmetry, you will eventually generate a soft-breaking Lagrangian. And basically, that soft-breaking Lagrangian is what's being studied at a hadron collider. It's the terms in that Lagrangian largely that are what are there. So if we can measure that Lagrangian, then we can go backwards maybe and begin to learn about the 10-dimensional theory. I'm going to talk more about the phases in a minute, because they really might play a very important role in all of this ish set of stuff. So let me spend a little time on that, because it's less familiar to most of you, I think. The Lagrangian masses, the soft Lagrangian masses, mostly are complex. And if you include all of the phases in the soft Lagrangian for the MSSM, and it would be more for an extended theory, then 40-some phases are present. And a lot of them are associated with flavor-changing effects, and so they wouldn't show up at a collider, basically, but still 10 or 15 could. How do the phases enter the high-energy theory? If we could get an idea what the phases were experimentally, then it has to tell us a lot about the underlying theory. The two kinds of ways that have been discussed at all for the phases entering, and it may be the only two that, or maybe one can organize everything in terms of these, are either by the compactification geometry, that is, as you get to four dimensions, you introduce necessarily some complex structure or not, or complex F-term BEVs, where if, for example, one of them were to dominate, then you wouldn't have a phase persisting because you could rotate it away. A few phases, basically two or three, are constrained by electric dipole moments, but most are not. The phases have a huge effect, and that's something that I've learned a lot of people aren't familiar with, so I'll go into a little detail on that in a minute. When you set the phases to zero, you can have very large changes in predictions compared to when they're non-zero. I think it will be not hard at all to develop techniques to study CP violation at the hadron colliders themselves. I think we know in principle how to do that, though not a lot of work has been done. But I think we've convinced some of the experimenters to do it, and that's one subject that needs a lot of work, is how to do it in practice and extract those phases. So let me give a little bit of detail on where they come from for those who aren't familiar. So in the soft Lagrangian, you have the SU2 Gugino mass and the mu term, and you have the parameter tangent beta, that's the ratio of BEVs when you get down to the after electroweak symmetry breaking. So the simplest example is here's the Chargino mass matrix in just the MSSM, so 2x2 matrix for the partner of the Wino and the partner of the Charge Takes Mixing. Then if you look at what the what you want to do is measure M2 and mu, but these are complex. And so you can, let's get the eigenvalues of the matrix, then C1 and C2 would be the experimental masses that the experimenters would actually measure if they could measure these mass eigenstates. But in fact, it's very hard to measure mass eigenstates at a hadron collider. To a good approximation, you can't do it at all. In a few special cases, you may be able to get a mass eigenstate measured, like a Chargino mass or a Neutralino mass or a Squark mass or a Gluino mass. But in general, you cannot do that. You can only measure combinations of them, as Paul illustrated this morning with some slides. But OK, here's the trace and the determinant to this, which are simpler equations. Here you can see these. But look at this equation from the determinant one. You can see that there are two, let's say that best two observables, the two masses, but the four parameters, M2 and mu, and tangent beta in this form. And the physical phase, the one you can never rotate away. You can rotate or combine one phase, but this is a physical measurable phase, as physical a phase as any mass or anything else. So you've got to have four observables at least to untangle four parameters, and that's hard. You could say, well, let's add cross-sections to get more information, but when you do, you start adding new particles and their couplings and their masses and so forth. So the production cross-sections do add information. The decays also add information, but again, they add more particles. This might be one of the main decays. So the bottom line is that, in general, this process never converges. It may, in some special lucky case. You can go to the Higgs sector, where people talk about at the tree level having only two parameters. But in fact, you know that in the Higgs sector, because the tree level Higgs mass is less than or equal to mz, and the experimental one, if you take a standard model like case, which isn't necessarily true, but if it isn't, it's because of these other things. And these add in quadratures. So this term, which has stop and top masses in the loop giving you radiative corrections and other stuff in loops perhaps associated with the bottom sector or the Chargino sector, these guys in loops give a big contribution, and they depend on more parameters. So when you're done, you have the soft masses m squared hu and hd, and at least one trilinear term, and at least one physical phase, again, that cannot be rotated away, and at least one stop mass, and a total of seven parameters. And again, so in the Higgs sector, if you don't have seven observables, you cannot untangle it in general. If you make assumptions, they better be right, or else you'll get that information when you try and sort this out. We've been trying to develop methods, and more I hope other people will. How do you go beyond this kind of limitation and begin to get a feeling for what's happening? So one thing we're doing is looking at signatures that you can really see. So same sign dileptons, events with prompt photons. Prompt experimentally means that they come from, they're energetic, isolated, and they come from the primary vertex, so it's like they were produced as a basic particle, not as a decay of something. Trilepton events, events with unusually many Bs, opposite sign dileptons, and you can make a list of 15 or 20 real observables at a collider, but none of these are in your Lagrangian, of course. Across the top, you can list your favorite theory, like gravity-mediated supersymmetry breaking with large mu or small mu or gauge-mediated or dilaton-dominated supersymmetry breaking, but you can take real theories and list them, and you will find as you go down the list that they give you a pattern which is characteristic of a given theory and different from others. So we're filling in this table, and other people can fill in their favorite pieces of this table, and you will find when you have data that most patterns are excluded, and that focuses you on a very special kind of approach, and then you can zoom in and make progress. This is just in case there was an experimenter or two that snuck in. But it's a minor point I want to make for us in the theory context. But these kinds of methods of looking at only at observables actually solve some of the experimental problems that have been holding up and will hold up things. Like, you don't have to know your beam luminosity or your jet energy correction so well. But that's not so relevant here. There are these obstacles, then, of the kind I've been talking about. the experiments only measure, experimenters can only report cross-section times decay branching ratios and some kinematical distributions. That's all they can do. If you want to interpret the data and learn about the underlying theory, you have to be able to go from this level to the theory level. I gave you this example with the charge genome mass matrix. It's true in general that without assumptions or other information of some sort, or luck, at a hadron collider, there simply are more parameters than observables, and you cannot invert. If you actually had a linear collider with polarized beams, you could do this, and this is the most important reason for having a linear collider. But we can't have a linear collider for, you know, if one is conservative and doesn't want to be contradicted, one says at least a decade after LHC starts taking data. And in practice, probably 15 years after LHC starts taking data is the earliest you could get a linear collider, if ever. So there's no point in thinking about it in the context of trying to do something. Then there's another kind of problem. Tangent beta only arises after electroweak symmetry breaking. It's not present in the high-scale theory at all. But every single low-scale prediction depends on tangent beta, sometimes a lot. So you need to measure it or understand it or something. And there are things you would like to do, like test gay genome mass degeneracy, and you can't measure the gay genome masses in general. So you've got these kinds of issues. So at LHC, there'll be a signal of some sort. 98% or so of the studies that are published simply work in the MSUGRA approximation, where there are four real parameters used to study something. It's certainly not well motivated, if at all, from a theoretical point of view. You don't get it from high-scale theories, and it could be very misleading, and I'll show you some of that. So I'm going to focus a bit on some of the things we can get from these inclusive signature plots, that, and everything that we can do with them, we can really do, because it's in terms of real observables, and we can take all those steps. And I'm not going to keep repeating, but there's no standard model stuff. I haven't done, nor have any of my collaborators done, any of the kind of things that ultimately must be done well to eliminate standard model things that can fake a signal. The paper that has some of the stuff in original form is this one, and it has references to a couple of earlier ones, and we're now doing several analyses that try and go ahead with this stuff. So this is an example. I'll show you a couple of these. The key with this example is that if MSUGRA were the right theory, it has to lie in this region. It doesn't cover the whole plane. So people like to say, well, you can do anything with supersymmetry, or you can fit anything. It's not true. This is an observable cross-section. In femtobarns, the cross-section for no prompt leptons plus two or more jets that pass the cuts. I'll show you the cuts. And I showed them on Monday, and they're in the paper that was handed out. And another cross-section. And MSUGRA must lie in this region. And these points right now are just to show you that stuff lies outside that region easily. These are, the red ones are normal, easy string constructions that are plausible ones that could perfectly well happen. So, you know the ingredients of this. Let's just repeat it in case. You have to, if you start top down, you have to have a high scale theory of some sort. Then you have to go to low scale somehow. The standard way in would be to get a four-dimensional high-scale theory at some string or unification scale and then use renormalization group equations. You calculate mass eigenstates, you run down, or you can run down the soft parameters and calculate the mass eigenstates at the low scale. You can do things various ways. And then once you have a spectrum, you can use a program like Pythia. These are just things you can put on your laptop, like Mathematica or something, and use them to start with your 10-dimensional theory and end up with some graphs that our predictions. There's a lot of obstacles to doing it right, and that's a big area for theorists to work in, like the kinds of exotic matter that Paul was mentioning this morning. If it's present, we'll change the renormalization group equations, but you don't know if it's there because you can't see it. So you have to do things like finding combinations of renormalization group things to run which aren't sensitive to the exotic states, or two different kinds of combinations that are sensitive to different ones. So if you get the same answers, then you have some reason to think it's okay and so forth. You don't know what scales to run from or to. There are a lot of issues to deal with that haven't been studied much. Here's another different kind of thing. This is the cross-section for trileptons with two or more jets versus no leptons with two or more jets. Again, AMSUGRA must be in this region. If there's ever a point seen outside of this, and you can make 20-some graphs or more with different kinds of observables, and if there's a point, a single experimental point on any graph outside of that region, then the world is not described by that theory. So this is much more sensitive than any kind of chi-squared test or any test that does any averaging or any distributions you can plot at looking for such things. And again, the red points are just typical cases. Here's a third one with a different set of things. And a fourth one. This is the narrowest one we found of all of them. The others are sort of typical of those. So now let me come again to the data at the beginning of the week. But now here's a piece of information for you. This is the AMSUGRA region, and here's the data point that we're presenting. So this technique lets us see right away that the point that I'm giving you cannot be an AMSUGRA point. It's an MSSM point, but not an AMSUGRA point. So that's a hint. No, four real parameters is AMSUGRA. That's what all the simulations have been done on, is four real parameters, yeah. So that's what I mean right here, right? Yeah. More generally, if you were including CP violation, you would allow those phases, but the ATLAS and the CMS studies are not done with those phases. If you just enter it in Google, you'll find it. And it will calculate the mass eigenstates from a soft Lagrangian for you at any scale. And it will do the renormalization group running up or down in any theory where in any MSSM theory. And it's got phases in it and various nice things. So it's a pretty good program. And there are others, but it's one of the most powerful ones now and one of the ones we... It's set up to do that. But it's not got opportunities for entering a lot of exotic matter or other things. But it's modifiable, so it's a good place to start if one wants to do this kind of stuff. So these are two of the programs that one wants to learn to run to do these things and get a sense of it. Wait, I can't quite hear. Can you say it louder? Oh, with other models? Oh, other programs to do stuff, yeah. Well, ideally, I mean, you know the answer. Ideally, I don't know which is best, because you have to get, they don't all give the same answers for every quantity. And so you have to run more than one of them if you want to trust it in detail. But one of the nice things about this kind of thing is that most of what they disagree on is inside the plots. So the question of where the boundary is interesting, and we're studying that. The question is sort of, if you take a different program, does that change where the boundary is? And we don't have a really good answer, but it doesn't change it much. So from this kind of point of view, you're much less sensitive to that than if you're relying on saying you're getting the Chargino mass accurately. And since you can't measure the Chargino mass accurately, I'm more concerned. I think this is a good way to answer that partially. But more work is needed on that, because we don't have really reliable stuff, as you know, to do that. The best comparison article I know of is from a conference a year or two ago by Juadi, Djouadi, who compared a number of programs and what they do. And checking for things that refer to that can get someone more information if they want. So here's the other data point I gave you explicitly. That is in the AMSUGRA region. So if you only looked at that, you couldn't tell whether it was AMSUGRA, but the other point is different. I changed the scale on these plots. That's why this one goes up to the boundary and the earlier ones don't. It's just that the the scale was only plotted here for, to make it fit inside. So those are the two data points, and there's the table of the rest of the information. One could have made all these other plots of this number versus this number and so forth, all the different ones. Notice that even these small numbers are reasonable numbers of events for LHC, that if you have four events in cross-section of femtomorans, oh, that is inverse femtomorans, that's a typo. 10 inverse femtomorans times 4 means 40 events in 1 year at a tenth of design luminosity. But these are actually small cross-sections for some of these things. So for lots and lots of models, you get cross-sections 10 times these, and you'll see them very quickly in those cases. Here's two more pieces of information then. Paul showed you this morning a spectrum with the opposite sign dileptons from one set of events, and he showed you a cutoff. And in the case he showed you, the signal beyond the standard model cutoff at 80 GeV. In the case of the signal that we found at LHC after a year's running, the endpoint was at 20 GeV. And Paul showed you this morning for the channel without leptons, the variable that was the missing transverse energy plus the transverse momentum of all the jets. And in our case, it's 715 GeV. And in the case Paul showed you, it cut off about 11 or 1200. I mean, the peak was at 11 or 1200 GeV, not a cutoff, but a peak in that case of the spectrum. So the question of whether it is supersymmetry, which is a common one, the same sign dileptons are a very good probe of that, that over sort of in some arbitrary measure, sort of 90 or 95% of the supersymmetry parameter space at LHC in a fairly short length of time, you'll have those events. And they're extremely characteristic because you get them straightforwardly if you have Majorana fermions in the theory. So gluinos or neutralinos will always give same sign dilepton events. The only question is the rate, which is very sensitive to details of the underlying soft Lagrangian. And in the case, in the rare cases where supersymmetry doesn't, one can find alternative things that replace them. So if you see a few same sign dilepton events, and it's very hard to fake them in the standard model, the standard model by itself won't fake them at all. You get it in secondary or tertiary decays sometimes, but those are easy to cut away if you have a reasonable grasp of the data. Then the one question is, how often do other kinds of models fake it? We're also working on trying to understand that a bit better, and the answer is not very often. We haven't got an answer yet that's clean, but they clearly don't fake it very often. And we're pretty sure that if we can find a model that fakes it a bit, then some other feature of that model will easily distinguish for us. So by summer sometime, we should have a significantly better answer to how to decide you've really seen supersymmetry. But that, I don't think, will be a real challenge to sort out. I think the harder thing will be, you've seen it, great. Now how do you learn from it any new physics about what the world is like, what supersymmetry breaking is like, what kind of theory it's pointing toward? Going beyond the simple fact of it is the whole big issue. So here's repeated the cuts if anybody has any questions about these are sort of typical cuts that are used for these kinds of analyses. But when there's data, it'll just be accompanied by a set of statements about what cuts were used. In programs like Pythia, when you put in, Pythia will take your soft Lagrangian and then put out events and let you plot graphs of distributions or cross-sections for different channels, and you simply insert these cuts. There are places where you just input this information, basically, in Pythia, and it makes the cuts for you, but you just have to give it the numbers. So this is the last thing I want to show, and it's to try and make the point that is really the main point I'm trying to make, or one of the two main points I'm trying to make, that here's just two kinds of events, trilepton ones and same sign dilepton ones, and that what they were, you could have picked any pair. And the letters represent some sort of string construction where you start with a 10-dimensional theory and you proceed, and at every stage where you can't derive something, you make a reasonable assumption about something that could happen in the structure of that theory to take you to the next stage. So you go to four dimensions and you have a supersymmetry breaking soft Lagrangian, and then you compute with those. And the main point is that they fall all over the place on a graph like that. Now, any typical one of them, each one is for one set of parameters. So now if you include the whole parameter range for it, you'll get some footprint like the Msugur one did. So this one will spread over some region like this, but it won't overlap the region from these on this plot in general, or it might possibly do it. But now if you make another plot, things which overlapped on this one won't overlap on that in general. And if you make a dozen plots, you'll find that you're really beginning to see that certain kinds of string theories plus a set of assumptions, so you have a path going down to the experiment. You could have taken a different path. So if you take different string constructions and paths, you've got dozens and dozens of approaches, but some of them will work, and then you can zoom in on those and look at them more closely. Or you might have your favorite one, and you can either find out quickly if it's wrong or if it's working, you can pursue it better and make better consequences from it. But the potential of this kind of study for really working your way back up and probing the string theory and helping you see what kind of string theory is giving signals like the data, the potential is there at least. If these had all been on top of one another, it would be sort of hopeless if they'd done that in all the cases. But it's not doing that. So I interpret that very optimistically, saying that when there's data, we will be able to learn a lot, maybe not enough, but we'll be able to get a lot of information from the data that will really point toward string theory physics, or if there's no such stuff, it'll tell us that to some extent, because it's really sensitive. That's the main point. So that's all I prepared to say. I'm not sure when we can discuss. Maybe somebody else wants to say something. We can have... What? The exercise is to figure out the 10-dimensional string theory from which the 2 points came. The two points are just the ones for which we made a graph. Here's, you can now plot another 15 graphs from these. So from those 17 pieces of information, you should be able to figure out the underlying 10-dimensional string theory and how supersymmetry is broken. And if that sounds silly, then the point is that when you're given data from LHC, it's going to look that silly. This is what you're going to get. No more. Right? Plus those two kinematical curves. I told you the cutoff point of one and the peak of another, and that's really all the information there is in those curves. So 20 pieces of information or so is all that we're going to get. And so this is kind of realistic in that sense. Can you talk a little louder, Mike? In the Monte Carlo programs like Pythia, giving you the right answer for things, it's basically square root of n in terms of their statistics. So that's one thing, but and if it's MSSM physics and doesn't involve phases, at this point Pythia is in pretty good shape for doing things pretty much right, and it's been used a lot and compared a lot. People are still finding small bugs, but that's probably not where the problem is, and it's going to be worked on. It's being worked on more and more. It's possible to put phases in. We did it for one paper. We put in one phase. And that's because I collaborated with Well, no, anybody can modify PIF, who can get into the program, and it's not that hard. A couple of my students know how to do it. If you want to do something really subtle, you need to talk to Steve Morena. Right. If anybody wants to do something, yeah, but, oh, okay, the rest of the answer is that if you're looking at something rare, then you have to really check that it's doing the right things. But anything where there's a fair number of events, it's basically okay now as far as is known, and there's no hint that it's not going to be basically okay. So things that are rare, you really have to check. Things that involve putting in new physics, which means basically anything involving phases or flavor-changing physics, that wasn't put in, and you bet if you, it, you have to check that it's been done right. And there's one world's expert in that, Steve Morena at Fermilab. So, and he's always willing to help people do things too. But anybody can do it. It's not a secret. It's not a black box that you can't get at. So it's pretty easy. It's not a huge time-consuming thing either to do it. So lots of people can learn to use it, and you can use it on your laptop, and you can play with it and do all this stuff and have fun. Take your theory, play with it, predict some stuff. If you want to really get in, if you really want to focus on a prediction, then it's good to check that by some other method that it's feasible. But you can often do that with a simple calculation once you have it. You know, you can always make an estimate. It's like other stuff. So these are not huge black boxes in some sense at this stage. So, and basically, it's trustworthy with the qualifications. You just give it the soft Lagrangian. These programs are set up to take. There's, to my knowledge, there's not anything useful. There might be, but I don't know of anything that doesn't simply take the soft Lagrangian and turn it into a spectrum by diagonalizing mass matrices, and or do renormalization group running, or calculate cross sections and stuff. The programs are set up to input stuff, use the Feynman rules for the MSSM, calculate cross sections. Do stuff like that, let you make distributions. But you have to give it your, you have to input the supersymmetry breaking in the form of a soft Lagrangian, plus a mu parameter. And it's actually a little tricky how you handle tangent beta. The programs like you to tell it tangent beta, but of course you don't know that till you've calculated it, so that's tricky. So sometimes you have to do something special, and on Friday when I show the answer to this, I'll show how we actually did this without pretending we knew tangent beta. That's why I showed you the first, the plots I showed you show that while there's parameters, they don't cover the whole plane of any set of cross sections. So there are continuous parameters, and they let you cover a footprint, but not a whole plane. Second, that's why I showed you the last graph, that the different string constructions have both, some have different ways of getting to four dimensions, some have different ways of supersymmetry breaking. Some of them are the same four-dimensional route, but two different ways of supersymmetry breaking. They lead you to a different region of the plot. And some do, some don't, of those points. We've studied a lot of different ones. No, the soft breaking Lagrangian is general. I'm sorry, maybe I misunderstood. The supersymmetry soft breaking Lagrangian is completely general. It's the most general Lagrangian you can write that doesn't introduce quadratic divergences in the theory. And so all theories have an effective theory at the string scale or something, which is describable by that soft Lagrangian. And that review article that Paul was talking about a few times, Chung et al., which is in Physics Reports as of last month, and on the web a year or some ago, that is 300 pages of review on the both the theory and the phenomenology of the soft Lagrangian and how general it is and what you have to worry about and so forth, including all questions of where you can get it and of things like phases that you might or might not have and so forth. Yeah, that review is the thing to study if you want to know all that kind of question. And in your department, Steve Goopser has been asking us questions about it, so he's got a copy. Well, how do you get a, if you have a 10-dimensional string theory, how do you get to 4 dimensions with supersymmetry broken? When you get to 4 dimensions with, let me try and answer it this way and see if it's clear. When you get to 4 dimensions with supersymmetry broken, your information is encoded in a superpotential and a gauge kinetic function and a Kähler potential. And with those three, all the information on how you got there is in those. And from those, you can, there's a known prescription to calculate any soft Lagrangian, soft breaking Lagrangian. So, well, I hope, no, I'm not assuming that, but you have to do more work if it's not. Yeah, the statement I made is true for, not for minimal supergravity, but for the general minimal supersymmetric standard model theories. And it includes all possible soft terms, sure. Yes, and the kinds of graphs that one, the constructions often end up telling you that there's a relation between one set of parameters and another, or that some are zero or something. So that gets embodied. But yes, all of these are always assumed to start out. And some of the stuff we're doing that's ending up with graphs like this, I should have brought some to show, but I didn't, is the full 105 parameters of the MSSM are present, and you can still do this kind of thing fine. And you still, in those theories, you get a superpotential and a Kähler potential and a gauge kinetic function from building up the theory. If you have a more general theory where you extend that, then there's an equivalent statement to make. But you still will get a soft breaking Lagrangian in 4 dimensions, apart from terms which are hard, could cause divergences. This will be general. If you add right-handed neutrinos, then there's some more parameters in that Lagrangian, but you still get a general soft breaking Lagrangian in such a theory. I've assumed that for the work we've done, I've assumed that for the exercise. Yes, the exercise is an MSSM theory. Yeah, but you don't have to do that in general. I mean, in terms of a string construction, if you had something that was different, although people, I don't know of any constructions in literature that lead to something outside of that framework, but there may be some. But you still can answer those questions. So by string construction, I mean a way of going from 10 dimensions to a superpotential plus a Kähler potential plus a gauge kinetic function. Yes, if you like, you can say that. But you know, in practice, you do it by saying you're going to compactify on a Calabi-Yau or a torus or something, and you do that, and then that may or may not break supersymmetry, and then you decide it's a Gugino condensate that breaks supersymmetry or vacuum expectation value of some F-term from some moduli field. And those lead you to the four-dimensional theory with those functions. And you can do that many different ways. And it's pretty general to take a path like that, but you can have, you can study anyone. The point I really want to emphasize is that if you do that, you get some predictions for the world, and they're different from if you do it a different way. And although you're making assumptions, you can then make some, you can get it so you can do some experimental input and feedback to your assumptions and actually learn something. So these are not orthogonal worlds. I can't hear too well. Maybe I'm not sure where the noise is, but louder. Yeah. Let Brent do it because he's really the expert on those. He studied them more than anyone else. Well, you can. So there were some D-brain models. There were some heterotic ones, Gugino condensation to break supersymmetry, F-term VEVs, lots of different choices. But one criterion in practice, as Brent said, was that we weren't going to work out a huge number of new things. We took stuff we could find to give these examples. But the point was not to make, say, any of them are better than others. It was to show that they're different. And anything else you look at is going to be different. Now, we're convinced of the differences and the sensitivity as being important. We're not favoring any kind of approach, of course. But as a way to argue that one can really take seriously connecting data, even in the form that experimenters will give it to us, with ideas, I find it compelling that we can learn to do that. Oh yeah, they range between 3 and 6 parameters, I think, in the different models, and they're not, the parameters are sometimes one of them, the parameter is the ratio of some Clebsch-Gordan coefficients from something to some other case. They're different choices of kinds of parameters, but not always standard ones, but you can convert those right away into soft Lagrangian parameters and then use those to run. Yeah, many models aren't formulated in terms of soft Lagrangian parameters. Right, I think that's where you were. Right, but all the models where they aren't, and that's in fact going to be more, it's going to be more common that your model is determined by physics that doesn't look like a soft Lagrangian, but it always leads to a soft Lagrangian and then you translate it. And the way that it does that will be clearer in every case, I think. Yeah. And we have concrete examples of that. Well, you could think that you're only going to determine the soft parameters. That would be good already, if you could. But I'm making a stronger statement. I'm saying that, for example, in the Amsugra case, those regions I showed, if the model's outside of that, then there is no set of soft parameters which work. If it's inside the region for something, then you can use this kind of approach to try and learn the soft parameters precisely. But the scatter of the different constructions on a plot means that you can maybe even get more information than just the soft parameters. In fact, I think you cannot measure separately the soft parameters. Let me give you an example. I think it's impossible at Hadron Collider, at LHC, to measure the Gugino masses M1 and M2. There's simply nothing that will let you measure those directly, as far as I can see. But you can ask the question, are they degenerate? Well, if they're degenerate, then the spectrum of leptons that you get from neutralino and chargino decays is different from the leptons you get if they're not degenerate. So I think you can actually test whether they're degenerate, maybe not 100% of the time, but at least you can find for a significant region of parameters that the Gugino masses are not degenerate or are consistent with being degenerate, even though you cannot measure them. I think that's something we can learn to do at LHC by just doing this kind of thinking or some equivalent better one that someone thinks of. But I don't think we can actually measure them ever at a hadron collider. And the same thing will repeat for the Higgs sector, maybe in other things. So one has to look. But I think we can learn a huge amount by being clever and using the patterns and the information and mixing it up with theoretical questions we want to test. But measuring the stuff is, at least I can't imagine a way yet to do it, unless we assume some theory and luckily we're right or something. Oh, no, they're irrelevant. In a string construction, for example, all of the particles that could be right-handed neutrinos, which might include half of the states of the spectrum or any once moduli get lifted, all of those, they have no effect at a hadron collider. If they did have an effect, it would show up in the Kähler potential or the superpotential or the gauge kinetic function and would be incorporated. No, you don't put anything to zero. You don't make assumptions like that. At all. On the contrary, you keep, I'm specifically saying don't do that. Keep phases, keep everything general, but they're all present in general. Yeah. They have very little, well, in some particular cases they're not. We did some things, but you can do this method with them all present. Sometimes then you have to, if you have your own theory, you have to redo that. If you have ones that do, then you have to do that stuff I said about testing the renormalization group. Yeah, you can't, right, you have to look at the whole thing consistently. But this method, these kinds of approaches, and I'm not just saying this method is great. I think it is the best we have so far. But people can invent better ones to do this. There's no point in assuming anything is zero. Extra U1 symmetries won't affect directly the collider things, but they may affect the soft Lagrangian terms and the renormalization group equations and so forth in ways that you need to take account of. So if you find something doesn't work or you get inconsistencies from two different ways of picking things out, then you know you did something wrong with that. And there's going to be better ways to test that. But it's possible to do it. It's not an insurmountable problem to do it, as you theorists are good at recognizing patterns and focusing on something, or they have a prejudice, and then you learn to test it. And historically, they've always moved very quickly to improve situations, including more stuff if needed. And of course, with the standard model, we found out the simplest thing worked, and you didn't need anything else.
Yeah.
That's actually a point I want to emphasize. I forgot. When you have the lightest superpartner being a dark matter candidate, you certainly don't want it to give you so much dark matter that you overclose the universe or exceed the upper bound on the upper bound of WMAP. That would be unreasonable. But most theoretical approaches that lead to dark matter that have some supersymmetric connection tend to generate dark matter non-thermally a lot of the time, from gravitino decays or other kinds of particle decays, or if there are scalar fields in the early universe, then they interact with this stuff, and they can that changes the Hubble parameter. So what's thermal equilibrium changes, and if you calculate the dark matter freeze out, it turns out that it enhances the amount of dark matter by surprisingly up to three orders of magnitude sometimes because of the scalar field changing the Hubble parameter a lot at early times. And so unless you're absolutely sure that your particle is actually making up the dark matter and you know all the cosmological history, don't assume a minimum from a given dark matter candidate, because it might be giving 10 to the minus 2 of the dark matter if you do a simple thermal calculation, but the rest of it is coming from decays from Affleck-Dyne things or gravitino decays or some other stuff. So anybody who's going to do this stuff, don't assume a minimum unless you have some great religious certainty about dark matter that isn't justified in theories in general. So that's just a side point on how to do this stuff. But you should make sure you don't disagree with any experiment as you do stuff. And that's these programs actually pretty much let you do that too. You don't have to do anything new. Essentially all of them have a way to quickly check that your soft breaking Lagrangian does not disagree with G minus 2 or beta S gamma or this stuff. It's people have written all these programs. Once in a while you have to make a slight change, but it's usually pretty clear what to do. Is excluded by for the whole MSSM, I guess I don't have a sense of that, but if I had to just naively say something, I would guess that 3/4 of the MSSM passes the whole thing. Well, but again, these plots, you never cover the whole of any plot, even though a large piece of it is available for any given thing. So an example is that if you look at these MSUGRA models, not MSSM, but MSUGRA, then they will tell you that the decay beta S gamma is a huge constraint. But that's because they don't allow in any of the analyses that lead to that any flavor-changing gluino contributions. Once you do that, then you completely change, that decay becomes essentially irrelevant as a constraint. Once you take off the lower limit on the dark matter cuts out a small fraction of the space, but not much. It's mainly the lower limit constraint that's the big thing cutting out. G minus 2, again, is a constraint, but the contribution G minus 2 grows as tangent beta times some stuff from superpartners. So if your theory in the MSSM tangent beta doesn't have to be, it might be hard to get the right Higgs mass with it being 2 or 3, but once it's bigger than 5 or 6, you can do it, and then all the way up to 60. So your mass contribution has a full order of magnitude range that's allowed and so forth. So you don't exclude too much, but you still better make sure that it's satisfied. But if you have a good theory, I would study it without worrying about those constraints first and then only get to them later if it's not. We haven't finished doing enough work so I can give you a good answer on that. But the computing is non-trivial for some of this, and that's the reason we haven't got more graphs to show. What we're actually doing right now, the paper we're getting ready, is one that will make it easy to settle the M-Sugra case. We're simply working out, and we'll post on the web all the plots that can be measured at LHC quickly. And if there's a single point on any one of them outside of the M-Sugra regions we'll post, then you can forget that approach. And so we've done the computing for that, and now we're starting some other ones. And I hope other people will do a lot of that stuff too. It's not terrible computing. It's mostly being done on laptops overnight at this point. So we could make it systematic and do it bigger. Well, that's why I mentioned those same sign dileptone events. That is very close to being, that's as unambiguous as you can probably get. And it's maybe, you know, I don't know exactly, but it's like 95% unambiguous in some sense. Because supersymmetry is the only general approach that has Majorana fermions that can be produced with big cross sections. And to get, in the standard model, you never see same sign events because you produce particle antiparticle or two things, but with conserved quantum numbers in the standard model, you never will get two main production things that have the same sign. You get it because you have Majorana fermions. So in supersymmetry, you produce a gluino and a gluino, but this is either a gluino or an anti-gluino. It doesn't matter because it's equal to it. If it decays as a gluino, it gives you one sign lepton. As an anti-gluino, it gives you the opposite sign, but they can both decay as gluinos, giving you the same sign. And only theories with Majorana fermions will do that in general. You can fake it a couple of ways, maybe, but my guess, we haven't finished that analysis. My guess is if you fake it, then there'll be very quickly another thing that is easy to distinguish. So if you don't, well, then we can identify one or two, maybe two regions of parameter space where the rate is just very small for practical reasons. But then some other rate is large, and we can pretty systematically see that. So, so we will answer that question. So there'll be an algorithm. Find same sign dileptons, or it doesn't have to just be leptons. It can be same sign B quarks, which is totally measurable too, and or top quarks. And then you're in, I think is going to be the answer. And if you don't, then check this and this. And so I don't think it'll be hard to pin that down. I don't need to. I mean, you can never prove all sorts of things like that. You have a theory, an approach that, and you find lots of signals. You don't just find one signal. You'll find several kinds of signals. You'll find the events where the lightest superpartner carries away missing energy. You may find the trilepton events where two of the particles give you this characteristic thing. Once you know a little bit, then you can say these have to be there too. And then there are better tests if you could get good enough. For example, supersymmetry is very definite in that because it's a generalization of a supersymmetrization of the standard model, left-handed quarks and leptons should couple to W's and have certain productions and decays that right-handed ones don't. That's very testable. It's even testable on some of these plots. They're not in the same region exactly, but we don't know yet how different it is. But there's a lot of stuff like that. If you had a linear collider of a proper energy, then you could make a long list of tests. But at the Hadron Collider, it's much harder. And at first, you'll just have these general ones. But you won't be unhappy if it walks like supersymmetry and talks like supersymmetry. OK, you won't see that, of course. And you won't test the spins. That's much too hard for Hadron Collider. To produce the things, to exchange them or something, right. Right. So I think with analysis, it'll become totally compelling. But I think at the New York Times level, it'll be easy. There'll be some clear signals, and you won't be nervous about it. It won't be like you're really wondering. Yes, we have to prove it, but that's not what worries me. What worries me is learning anything from it. I think this is going to be a case where the experimenters are not happy with us. In the case of LEP, the main things that were learned were things like the gauge coupling unification. The experimenters measured the gauge couplings at one point, and then deciding that they unified took theorists doing the running. And so most of the experimenters weren't very happy about that. In the case of the upper limit on the Higgs mass, it was the theorist's role was only helping with the radiative correction, so you could get that right and define the chi-squared plot that put the upper limit. And on the case of saying that it's softly coupled, weakly coupled, you had to have the one and sometimes two loop radiative corrections to all the decays of the Z. So the theorist's role was calculating standard model stuff. But here, they're just going to report, they'll find signals beyond the standard model. But they'll have no way to decide what it is or what it implies. And that's going to be done mainly by theorists maybe working with them. And it's going to be the theorists who have to take the lead and who are going to take these signals that are uninterpretable. There's going to be nothing in the raw data that says that it's supersymmetry, except that we tell them Majorana fermions. Yes, they'll see same sign dileptons, but they won't have the evidence for that. It's going to be theorists on whom the responsibility lies to go forward in this case. And Because of the software like Pythia, you don't need experimentalists to do it. So once they've built the detector and run it, don't quote me. Everybody bored? So figure it out.
But then it's to start with minimal supergravity with the four parameters and see whether you can fit choose these four parameters to fit the data. That is the starting point. And then if you cannot, then you'll find out
in 10 minutes that you can't with that. Yeah, I mean, I don't think it'll take any trouble.
So you have then to start.